Hello, I'm Trevor Dan. Two features this week. Stuart Clarkson's been talking to Johnny Beerling, who ran Radio 1 in its smashy and nicey days of the 1980s and early 90s. And I've been to the RAIN Summit in London to hear about the latest thinking on online audio.
The Radio Today programme, with Broadcast Bionics, creators of Phonebox and Oasis. Welcome to the Social Studio.
You found the Radio Today programme, the weekly podcast from Radio Today, and we're back this week at the Royal Institution. We were here for Next Radio not long ago, and we're here today for the RAIN Summit. Now, Kurt Hansen is with me. What's RAIN?
Hi, Trevor. It's an acronym for Radio and Internet News.
Now, on the basis of today, is radio and the internet going to be the same thing?
Yes, in the long run, absolutely. I'm a big Star Trek fan, so I figure by the 2200s, it's inevitable. And the only question is when. So
do you think that broadcast, as we now think of radio, is just going to slowly decline while internet, online, on demand is going to slowly go up in the opposite direction?
Yeah, slowly to medium. That internet radio and podcasting is growing in audience in many countries at 20, 30, 40% a year. So, you know, medium fast, maybe. We'll see.
What were the main themes that emerged today at the conference for you?
I guess actually Europe is kind of learning from kind of the pros and cons of what's happened in America and North America the last 15 years or so. And at the moment, feels like it's rushing ahead. There's a lot of interest among consumers and among broadcasters and in the advertising community. I'm really optimistic about the speed of things happening.
You've been talking a lot today, haven't you, about how any of us can make any money out of this stuff. Are we any closer, do you think, to delivering some actual revenue from digital audio?
Oh, yeah. In the U.S., Pandora will be doing $1 billion a year in sales this year, and Spotify's moving in that direction. Probably not there yet, but moving in that direction.
I'm going to say, though, Kirk, there'll be people listening to this saying, Pandora, Spotify, they're not radio.
Well, you know, there were people in the 70s and 80s that said that FM radio was not radio. They had their reasons for it, but if you did not own an AM radio station, you could not belong in the U.S. of the National Association of Broadcasters, because FM was not proper radio. It's different, just as FM was different from AM, internet radio is different than AM/FM, but it doesn't make it not radio.
So it doesn't really matter what platform we're consuming it on. I mean, not that anybody in the real world ever uses the word platform, but whether it's coming out of a radio set or a smartphone or the television, it's still radio, isn't it?
You know, if you pick your own songs, it isn't radio. Just like when you had a stack of LPs and you picked which song you wanted to hear next, that wasn't radio. But as soon as there's an outside intelligence, whether it be human or machine, that's helping select the programming for you, or in the talk world, if it's, you know, people talking, I think that's the dividing line where I would say if it's someone else picking it, it's coming from a distance, and it's going to multiple people, I'd call that radio.
What is, in your world, Kurt, a podcast?
Well, that's an interesting question. The short answer, of course, is any piece of on-demand audio where you typically talk, because there are licensing issues about music. But there's kind of a new definition that it's archived programming if it's originated on broadcast, and it's a podcast if it's custom content created for online. So you could use either definition.
Which is difficult in, you know, you look at sort of 99% Invisible starts as a podcast, becomes a radio show. Serial, is it a radio show, is it a podcast? We're always stuck, aren't we, in this modern world with semantic problems. It's vocabulary often that gets in the way.
Yeah, you know, I guess I'm comfortable with if it's a piece of audio content that you choose to listen to on demand and it's talk-based, or it's a program, I'd call it a podcast.
So what is RAIN doing here? Why have you come to the UK?
This is our fourth annual event in Europe. We started in Berlin, went to Brussels, came to London last year, liked it a lot, came back this year. Just kind of trying to evangelize for the growth of online audio.
Kurt Hansen is the founding editor of Radio and Internet News. You can find them at rainnews.com. Still to come on this podcast, the latest UK radio news from Roy Martin and David Lloyd's Radio Moments. But first, a journey back to the days before the internet, before digital radio, when the jocks of 1FM bestrode the radio planet. Johnny Beerling was its controller in the 80s and early 90s, before he was ousted by John Burt and replaced by Matthew Bannister. It's not a period many people in radio celebrate, but as Stuart Clarkson discovered, Johnny is unrepentant.
The Radio Today programme with Broadcast Bionics.
Hello, I'm with Johnny Beerling, who's revised his book. It's called Inside Radio 1, and the man here is going to tell us about
Hello, Stuart. Nice to be with you.
So tell us why you decided to revise it. It's a book you wrote a few years ago.
Yes, I did. I wrote it for Radio 1's 40th anniversary, and we're approaching the 50th now. So I thought it was time to update it in the light, particularly of what had happened with Jimmy Savile and some of those recent developments. And I thought I could make a better book of it, frankly. I put more colour pictures in and revised some of the stories and what have you.
And it's essentially a trot through your life in radio.
Yes, it is. It covers the period from 1957 when I joined the BBC to 1993 when I left it. After that, it's not my responsibility.
So what was it that got you into radio in the first place? Why did you want to work in radio?
Going back a long way now, my dad was always keen on radios. You know, he used to wind his own coils and build transformers. And so I suppose it was put into me in a very early age. And then when I did my national service, which we had to do back in those days, before I went to college, I wanted to be a pilot, but I, for various reasons, didn't succeed in that ambition. So they said, what else would you like to do? And I said, well, Dad was always keen on radio. I'd like to learn about radio. And so they trained me as a ground wireless fitter, and I finished up after 9 months training at Compton Bassett down in Wiltshire, responsible for servicing all the equipment that the Air Force used in the control tower and in the various offices and what have you around the Air Force. So that was good fun, and I got posted to Aden in the Middle East, which is a very hot place. I was so fortunate, you know, life is quite like that, isn't it? Sometimes things crop up and it works out for the best. But the chap who had been the studio technician at the Aden Forces Broadcasting Association, he was going home. He'd finished his 2 years service, and the boss said, would you like to take over? And I said, wow, that sounds fantastic. I've always been keen on radio. To work in it, you know, for a best part of a year would be wonderful. And so I became the studio technician for the Aden Forces Broadcasting Association. Now, there was one drawback to that, because they said, you also have to do the early morning broadcasting. Well, I'd always fancied myself as a sort of budding David Jacobs or Pete Murray. So I had to get up at 5 o'clock in the morning, go on the air from 6 till 8. We did the early morning request program and played records. And then from 8 till 8:30, we relayed the general overseas service of the BBC. And so that was my life for the best part of 9 months. I was doing that down there.
And you mentioned David Jacobs and Pete Murray. You then went to work for the BBC and got to meet these people.
Got to meet them and actually started playing the records for them. Well, what happened was, whilst I was in Aden, a chap came out. He had a marvellous job. His name was Peter West. He wasn't the famous Peter West, but he had to go around the world checking on the reception of the General Overseas Service to see how we relayed it and what sort of aerials we had and what the signal was like and so on. So he took me to lunch. This was my first ever business lunch. There I was, about 18 and a half, 19. And he took me to the Rock Hotel in Aden, and we had lunch. And I said, you know, I don't really want to be a school teacher. I'd like to work in radio full time. Oh, I'll put a word in for you, old chap, when I get back. That was the start of it all. I came back and knocked on the door of the BBC, and they invited me to join as a technical operator. Now, I was so naive then, I thought, well, a technical operator would be the man who operates the equipment in the studios and does the sound mixing and what have you. I found out after I was in, it was a bit like being press ganged, that what you were doing there was to, polish the double-ended jacks that connected various things, monitor things in the bowels of the BBC, and make sure the studios were all working. And I found out that the people who did the operating were called studio managers, terribly posh, and they all had degrees in sociology or philosophy or something. They didn't seem to know much about engineering. But the attitude of the BBC was that these people are artistic, and you can't possibly be artistic if you're an engineer. So I was an engineer and I had to change from being an engineer, a technical operator, to become a studio manager. Of course, I didn't have a degree, but I was very lucky. Somebody took a chance on about six of us, and six TOs eventually got trained up as studio managers, and we learned how to mix sound, how to play records, how to edit tape, which was just coming in those days, and it was wonderful. I took to it, you know, just I thought it was the most marvellous thing I could possibly do. I didn't have any ambition to do anything more than just become a studio manager, playing the records for programmes like Housewives' Choice and Two-Way Family Favourites, and, of course, Pete Murray and David Jacobs. Wonderful time.
10 years at the Light programme, and essentially you were producing programmes there by the end.
Yes, that was 1957 that I joined, and I went on, and Radio 1 started in 1967, 10 years later. There were two departments that made programmes in the old Light programme. There was the popular music department. They were the boys that recorded sessions in the BBC studios and mixed them with records. And then there was the gramophone department, terribly posh. The gramophone department was run by a formidable lady called Anna Instone, and she was responsible for any programme that used commercial records, whether it was classical or pop. And so I worked for Anna Instone in the gramophone department and was appointed a producer there after about 5 or 6 years. And so I too was then producing things like Midday Spin and Housewife's Choice.
So when Radio 1 was going to come along, they kind of picked you and a few other people to work on it ahead of launch?
Yes, those of us that had been in popular music and in gramophone departments were asked which new station we wanted to work with. Naturally, having come from a sort of pop music background and an interest in big bands and music, I opted to work for Radio 1. And I had been producing the last sort of year of the old Light programme, a show called Where It's At on Saturday afternoons with the infamous Chris Denning. But he was a good DJ despite his other shortcomings. This was very much modelled on pirate radio. We even made our own jingles because the BBC didn't have jingles in those days. So I would cut the beginnings and ends of big band records together and get Duncan Johnson with his dark brown voice to say, "The Light programme news," you see, or whatever the feature was that I wanted. So we made up little jingles. Kenny Everett used to make up spoof commercials, which we dropped in, which is very odd on the BBC. Croxton's Thigh Jelly, I remember, was one of the products. You can read all about it in the book.
Anyway, yeah,
and I think it was scripts from one or two of those.
There is a lot in the book as well, obviously, about the birth of Radio 1, and a lot of people know about that already, so we won't go into too much detail about it. But here it was, 1967. You've got half the DJs from the pirate stations, half the DJs from the Light programme and elsewhere.
Well, it was a very strange blend of people, if you remember, because people like Stuart Henry and Roscoe were in caftans and bells and beads, and people like Don Moss and Pete Murray and David Jacobs were all in their suits with their ties because they had been brought up that way in the BBC. So you had a sort of a mixture of the cultures from the two backgrounds. But it was fun, and I can remember very clearly John Dunn, who later became a well-known Radio 2 personality, but he was a newsreader on the opening day, and at 12:30 in the middle of Emperor Roscoe's show, he was going, "Have mercy, Mr. Percy," and so on. He said, "Oh, now here is the news in English."
And obviously you were Tony Blackburn's first producer on The Breakfast Show. You went on to be a senior producer through the 70s,
yes.
And you seem to have had a lot of freedom to come up with ideas and just run with things.
Yes, I did. I suppose I wasn't conscious. I wasn't particularly ambitious. As I said, I'd never had any ambition beyond wanting to be a studio operator. Then when I became a producer, I thought, this is a wonderful job. And I suppose my natural enthusiasm came through. I was always thinking up new ideas and different things. And one of the things I thought was that by 1972, we knew that commercial radio in the UK was coming. And I thought that we have to get away from this perception that Radio 1 is that station down there in London, living in Yorkshire. Now I can understand that even better. But there is a perception, isn't there, that the BBC is London-dominated, which is why we have the media city at Salford now. So I devised a programme called the Radio 1 Club. This was an adaptation of a programme that originally Derek Chinnery had produced called Pop In. The idea of Pop In was that literally the audience could wander into this converted cinema in Lower Regent Street and see a DJ playing records, but also meet some of the pop stars who would turn up for interviews to promote their latest record. And so Radio 1 Club, the idea was that people would sign up, become members, get a membership card, and they could come into the club. And rather than just do it in the Paris cinema in Lower Regent Street, we would do it in various places up and down the country and use the power of the BBC and the various offices that we had in Manchester, Birmingham, Belfast, Glasgow, and so on. And so originally we started just doing it two ways. We'd do one in Manchester mixed with one in London. We'd have two presenters, one at each end, and live groups playing from the area. I mean, it was great fun, and it was hugely popular. In fact, it was so popular, after about 4 years, we had to take it off because there was so much truancy and people getting away from...
And instead you took took a van to beaches instead and around the coast.
Well, then after a gap of 18 months or so, I had a young family then, and we used to take them on holiday to France, camping. And I was down in the south of France one night, and I saw these people trotting along with their little aluminium chairs, and being nosy, I wandered and followed them. And there they were in front of a big Arctic vehicle with a stage that opened up from the side. And they were doing a show which is a bit like a sort of radio version of Sunday Night at the London Palladium, with live bands playing and comedians and what have you. And I thought this would be a marvellous way to promote Radio 1 if we could do something similar and take it round the seaside resorts of the UK. And thus was born the Radio 1 Roadshow.
Obviously, the roadshow and the merchandise did what you'd intended it to do, because through the 70s and the 80s, it was this massive radio station, the biggest in Europe.
Yes, and I'd seen the way... I was a very great fan, along with Noel Edmonds and Mike Smith, of Formula One racing, and we'd seen the way the teams were all branded up, and I thought we should follow this through and brand Radio 1. And our colours were red, white and blue, and we had the famous ice cream jackets, as somebody used to say behind my back, Beeling with his ice cream jackets. But it did work. I mean, everything was branded. We used to get a car from Ford's press fleet, and they would give us a little white Escort Mexico, which the producer would drive around in, and that was branded up. So everything was promoting Radio 1 and getting it into a strong position before commercial radio started.
Yeah, and at the time that you then stepped up from being one of the senior producers to controller... was at a time where that explosion of commercial radio was happening, I guess.
Yes, it was. By then I was an executive producer, and we came up with the notion of expanding the roadshow and the Radio 1 Club into Radio 1 Weeks Out. And by a strange coincidence, these Weeks Out always happened when there was a new commercial station happening. I think the first one we ever did was in Manchester when Piccadilly was opening. And for that, we saturated the town.
Looking at your last 8 years then at Radio 1, where you were the big boss... there was a lot went on then. You had Live Aid, you went on FM.
Oh, my word, yes.
Big changes going on,
wasn't it? Continual struggle, you know, from when Radio 1 started. It took 20 years before we got an FM network, which is really evidence, I think, of the lack of faith that senior management in the BBC ever had in the thing. They probably were somewhat embarrassed that they were having a station that did nothing but play music, popular music all day. And so everybody else, I mean, the commercial stations all were on AM and FM, and poor old Radio 1 was on 247 metres, which was an appalling service. I mean, it was almost as bad as Radio Luxembourg after dark. About half the country couldn't hear it, and it was fading in and out. It was sort of on the same frequency as Radio Albania, so that was difficult. And then a bit later, they relented, and they gave us the old Radio 3 medium waves, which was 275 and 285, or 1089 and 1053, if you wanted in kilohertz. And so we had to promote the changeover and get people to switch over. And then eventually we got one VHF FM transmitter in the southeast of England. And then eventually, after 20 years, they finally found the money and the space to put us on FM across the whole country, which was just a wonderful time. And that coincided with 1985, when I took over, with the opportunity to broadcast Live Aid.
So when the early 90s came along, you got this 25-year-old radio station that's still got a lot of the listeners who were listening 25 years ago. The BBC decided they want to change it, and you weren't going to be a part
of
that.
That was one of the problems. I'd been there far too long by then. I'd been there since it started, and 25 years later I was still there. And the audience was still there. It hadn't changed. You know, people liked it so much they didn't switch over. I realised there needed to be changes, and John Burt was particularly keen. He was worried that the BBC's charter would be renewed and they would have Radio 1 taken away. So he wanted Radio 1 to be young and radically different. Now, I didn't object to this, but I could see the problem, and what I wanted to do was to take a lot of those older disc jockeys like Dave Lee Travis, Simon Bates, Steve Wright, Alan Freeman, Bob Harris, Gary Davis, take them to Radio 2. I said, let me go and run Radio 2, and then you can change Radio 1. You can use the power of the BBC's marketing to move the audience across. John Burt didn't want to do that, nor did Liz Forgan. She was the managing director of radio by this time. And She thought it would disadvantage the existing Radio 2 audience. So I left, and it took another 10 years before Jim Moyer came along and did exactly what I'd outlined, and now Radio 2 is the big station. But had they done it the way I had suggested, I maintain they needn't have lost the audience that they did, because Matthew Bannister took over from me and did what John Burt wanted, made it a young person station, but he changed everything so radically that he got very bad press and they lost about 10 million listeners, which was unnecessary, really. They could have done it in a more subtle way.
The book will be enjoyable by people who work in radio and people who just have memories of listening to radio.
Yes, I think so. I mean, you have to think... It started nearly 50 years ago, so if you're in your 20s then, you'll be in your 70s now. So it's a nice Christmas present for anybody who's got a sort of with it granny or grandma, you know, and say, you remember you used to listen to Radio 1 when you were 20, granny? Well, you know, here you are. So I do suggest that anybody who's interested in radio would find it a very suitable Christmas present, and they can get it off my website, www.johnnybealing.co.uk. But I'm very happy to sign it and put a personal message in if people want to have one.
Johnny Bealing was talking to Stuart Clarkson, and you can watch a longer version of that interview filmed in Johnny's conservatory in Yorkshire on the Radio Today YouTube channel. See the link from radiotoday.co.uk. News now, here's Roy Martin.
The big news this week then is that Alex Dyke has been found in breach of the broadcasting code for his comments about breastfeeding in public on BBC Radio Solent. The BBC Trust also agreed he was in the wrong. The comment stepped significantly beyond what would have been deemed acceptable by listeners, the BBC Trust said, and Ofcom found the show in breach of Rule 2.3, no less. Capital's Jingle Bell Ball has sold out within 1 hour. It's the quickest the event has ever sold out. It's sponsored by Coca-Cola again this year and has Justin Bieber and Ellie Goulding on the lineup, amongst many others. And you can see the full winners list from the Student Radio Awards last week on our website. And all the photos we took on the night are now on our Facebook page as well. Get tagging. That's the very latest from radiotoday.co.uk. I'm Roy Martin.
Broadcast Bionics, creators of Phonebox and Oasis, offer you elegantly integrated products and intelligent one-stop shopping for all your studio needs. Discover a full range of innovative studio products. Play out by Wide Orbit, Music Master Scheduling, Stirlitz, Newsboss, Larvo, Telos, Axia, Omnia, Digigram and Commotion. Visit bionics.co.uk today.
Radio Moments. David Lloyd.
Sorry, I'm a little preoccupied this week. I'm just doing a little bit of babysitting.
Birth of a station. Good morning, everybody. This is BBC Radio Birmingham, your local radio station for Birmingham, Coventry, Wolverhampton and the Black Country, broadcasting on 95.6 VHF.
I spent the night of the opening day at the Queen Elizabeth Hospital waiting for the first baby to be born. His name was Robert Clifford Joyner, and as far as I know, he's still going strong.
I am still going strong. I did a first degree at Essex University in Colchester in the early 90s. Then I had a period of working different jobs, and then I sort of got into acting.
Yes, happy 45th birthday this week to Robert and to the BBC in the West Midlands. And the first presenter proper on that station wasn't much older than that baby, actually.
I was, quite frankly, useless. I think I lasted 9 months, which is actually about 8.5 months longer than I should probably have lasted. I didn't really know what I was doing. I was making it up as I went along. I didn't think I was particularly funny. I was only 18.
Peter Powell launching BBC Radio Birmingham from the new Pebble Mill this week in 1970, now BBC WM. We should also congratulate BBC Local Radio itself, really. It launched this week in 67.
Good afternoon from Radio Leicester, broadcasting on 95.05 VHF.
We should be on the air about 17 or 18 hours a day, and about 4 hours of the 17 will be local output. Now, these aren't 4 hours together in one block. Mainly, they will be in the early morning, at lunchtime, and in the early evening.
BBC Local Radio beginning in Leicester this week, 48 years ago, inspired by Frank Gillard. And a 72-year-old Frank would likely have enjoyed this new addition to his fold in 1980.
This is the brand new sound of BBC Radio Lincolnshire. Our transmissions begin this morning with an address by the Bishop of Lincoln, the Right Reverend Simon Phipps. But before we hear from him, we're going over now live to Lincoln Cathedral, where the band of ringers are waiting to welcome Radio Lincolnshire.
Good morning to you on the birthday of BBC Radio Lincolnshire. I've got two very good neighbours here in Lincoln. One of them's very old and the other's very young.
Happy 35th anniversary to BBC Radio Lincolnshire. Staying with 1980 now, and we're off to beautiful Devon.
So that's the weather. Now then, what else? Some other things that we'll be doing is to be giving farmers relevant information at 6.15 every weekday morning. And this morning, Hugh Kroll is in the studio. What do you got for us today, Hugh?
Well, Bob, today there are one or two items which I think will be of interest. Firstly, there's one about money, and there is a beef cow suckler scheme which has been introduced by the EEC.
Not many stations get into farming news within 15 minutes of going on air, do they? Well done, Devon Air, launching this week in 1980. It lost its licence, of course, to Gemini 14 years later, and is now part of Heart. It's often radio interviews which end up making the headlines. Away from the lights and cameras and inexperienced hands, they can change history.
But you must have known what happened, because a tweet was put out 24 hours beforehand, telling the world, 12 hours beforehand, telling the world that something was going to happen on Newsnight that night that would reveal extraordinary things about child abuse and that would involve a senior Tory figure from the Thatcher years. You didn't see that tweet?
I didn't see that tweet, John. I now understand.
Why not?
I check Twitter sometimes at the end of
you
the day, or
staff.
I don't check
you have
it
an
at
enormous
all.
Staff of people who are reporting into you on all sorts of things.
It's not often that an interview with your boss ends up with his resignation. Humphreys versus Entwistle this week, 3 years ago, on the Radio 4 Today programme. Radio also made the news this week in 1976 when Enoch Powell's appearance on Any Questions was disrupted.
This, ladies and gentlemen of the listening public, is rather like being in some sort of variety hall. Gentlemen are popping up from all sorts of parts of the hall, and I suppose we will manage to carry on. We will. Bishop, I'm sure that the bishop here, if you'll allow me, Lord Robins, Bishop, I'm sure you have a way of calming down people.
People are going to love one another.
Controversial politician Enoch Powell heckled on Radio 4 and beautifully handled by David Jacobs. We should say happy birthday to one of the radio gods this week. He's 50.
It is raining, but the election artist's assistant is holding an umbrella above the satellite phone, so we might just be all right.
That'll Let me tell
Well, there you are. What are we going to do now? We're going to try and get back in touch with Nigel? Okay, we're going to try and get that broadly to work and see if it'll do the trick with our satellite. I do have some... Can you hear Paddy O'Connell coming into the studio? We do have some more emails I wanted to bring.
Happy birthday, Eddie Mair from BBC Radio Scotland, BBC 5 Live, and now stunning on Radio 4's PM. So, with the launch of BBC Wales this week, 37 years ago...
On FM. AM. DAB. TV. And on your mobile.
This is BBC Radio Wales.
Peter Levy returning to his radio roots on Radio Humberside 7 years ago... Peter Levy. XFM Scotland becoming Galaxy Scotland 7 years ago. Scotland doesn't like the name XFM, does it?
Here's a radio station that loves music too.
Vera Lynn getting her radio gig 74 years ago.
A letter from home to the forces from Vera Lynn and Fred Hartley.
And Kelvin's Talk Co Holdings buying Talk Radio, now Talk Sports, 17 years ago. Those are this week's Radio Moments. Radio
Moments. David Lloyd in fine form as ever. Credits also this week to Stuart Clarkson, Roy Martin, Kurt Hansen, Johnny Beerling, and of course you for listening. Keep an eye and ear open for our Radio Today programme Extra this week, where we'll have Alan Davey, controller of Radio 3, and John Tierrent from Jazz FM talking about their new collaboration on the pop-up station BBC Music Jazz, which opens this week. And if you're in Salford, I'll see you at the Nations and Regions Conference next Tuesday. This has been a TDC production. Ta-da!
The Radio Today programme with Broadcast Bionics.